commissions, or suggest you use bioelectric shields for better trading. Individual education is our only agenda. Listen as we teach you to achieve realistic financial goals using your brain, free tools, and solutions. Now, here's Vince Rowe.
Today, as we enter our sixth year of doing this show, I'm always guarded when I always use the term because I hear it overused, is the fact that this is a very special show, but I honestly believe that this is one of those very special shows that I'm going to go and hopefully keep in the archives as is the initial inaugural show and probably refer back to it many times, and we will hopefully continue with this theme. As you know, over the years, I bought Ron Miller on and his merry band of men across the country that are SEC litigators, and Ron gives us an update on all the cases that he can talk about, the class action lawsuits that I actually led with the Invest Tools that they've actually paid out on, and a few other things, and been in a lot of those, you know, those type of grassroots operations to weed out those, you know, less than savory in the financial markets. And for many years, I'd had Ron come on and Michael Hume and all those guys that, go in the court and help us out. Today, and in helping me out with this show, because it is somewhat of his interest as well, is Dan Kofall, who's normally on 4 to 6 today, but you're going to see a ghost show of his this evening, and we'll talk about it. Dan, are you out there?
You bet, brother. How are you?
I wanted to bring you on just before this, and I want to give a little bit of disclaimer. Is that my guest today is kind of a unique situation. It's kind of a close personal thing to me, and Dan has been actively involved in this, and this gentleman has been one of those folks that he and I have been, you know, pointing people to in the thousands. And saying, here's where you need to keep up with him. His name is Chuck Gallagher. And if there is anybody in the same theme and the same strain of why I got pushed into the financial markets as just an executive and a guy that wanted to learn how to do this and being ripped off for $43,265 on these hotel conference death by PowerPoint presentations with the secret systems and the red light, green light, black boxes, is that I wish I would have found him a lot earlier than now, because I think he and I would have collaborated over the years a lot. But his name's Chuck Gallagher. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Vince. Appreciate it.
So, Chuck, I don't think there'd be anybody else better to give your resume and some of your background than yourself, and I think that your story is a very unique one, and I think it's one that I wish there were more people like you that would go out and, you know, do the, you know, some of the tough love stuff that, you know, some people just refuse to do and help others out. But you've really dedicated your speaking and some of the stuff that you do to, you know, going out and weeding these things out that you and I both know that are in the thousands that are out there, yeah?
Well, you're right. They are in the thousands that are out there. And as you say, typically when I'm invited on a show, one of the things that first comes up is okay, well, what's the story? And I always have this kind of lump in my throat thinking, wow, I wish I could say something that was extremely positive and uplifting. And the fact is...
That's not a motivational speaker, is it?
Yeah, well, you know, in the 80s, I thought I knew it all. In my high 20s or going into my early 30s, I mean, I thought I had this bull by the horns. I was a CPA. I was a tax partner in a firm. I had testified before Congress. I taught in 30 states, wrote articles. I mean, the career seemed like it was going to skyrocket, but Vince, unfortunately, I had the perception that success was a function of stuff, material items. Mm-hmm. That really successful people were the folks that had the best homes, that drove the nicest cars, that had the Armani suits, that had the Rolex watches. And there's nothing wrong with any of the things that I'm mentioning, as long as you get them legitimately.
Right, right.
In my case, however, I say to many folks, I was overextended and underfunded. Put in today's terms, for 2008, 2009, and 2010, in the biggest recession we've had since the Great Depression, I had too doggone much debt. I lived off of debt. And instead of doing the right thing, which I, by the way, knew what that was, but instead of doing the right thing, I unfortunately created a Ponzi scheme, now a term that it seems like most Americans are familiar with, since mm-hmm. Bernie Madoff clearly brought a lot of attention to the concept. But in the 80s, I created a Ponzi scheme, and I say today, and it is a true statement for anybody, anywhere, at any time, and that is every choice has a consequence. And the consequence of mine was a stint in federal prison.
Mm-hmm. That's tough time indoors, huh?
Wow.
Well, you hear people talk about it as like going to Club Fed, and I have often said to folks, you might want to try it just to see what you think of the experience. It isn't riding horses, playing polo, sitting around, you know, having a nice hand of gin rummy or whatever it happens to be. It is Fed. There is no club to it other than you're assigned a number, and that number will stick with you for the rest of your life.
Right. Well, let me check my list here. Dan, it's not on mine. My bucket list. Is that on your bucket list?
pretty much not. Maybe just to walk through and say, gee, I'm glad I'm not here.
Right. Yeah, so that's tough, Chuck. That was a tough time. How long were you indoors?
Well, I was sentenced for my crime. I was sentenced to 18 months active, 3 years probation. And I have to say, just kind of as a side note, when Bernie Madoff got sentenced to 150 years, I took his $65 billion into the 150 years and then extrapolated that to what I stole and repaid, but that doesn't change the fact that I stole it. And I got screwed. I really should have gotten about 5 months based on Bernie's sentence. But nonetheless, I did my time, and while I will never want to go back, I will say to you and to the audience, it was the best experience that could have ever happened to me.
Well, it was defining. Is that, you know, my experience was is that when I was getting out of college, I thought drinking was the major thing that I'd learned. And if I hadn't gone into the military for what I thought was going to be 2 years, I went for 10 years, I wouldn't be the same person today. You know, and that
absolutely
really set me on course was the military. And my dad knew it, and I think everybody else knew it except for I didn't know it. But I thought it was a punishment. But it changed my life. I think that, you know, some of us need that significant emotional event to put us on path sometimes, huh?
Well, most of us, at some point in time in life, will find that we will have those moments or those experiences that are, in fact, life-defining. And in this particular case, it was for me. And the question wasn't so much what got me there or the time that I spent there. The question that really is defining is, what do you do when you get out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. Exactly, and that's where I really want to go, because most people would not give back. And we just heard another story of a guy being sentenced today in Kansas City by the reporter that was covering it, and he's being sentenced, and this is his third time. This is his third time that he'd actually bilk investors, and that's going to happen. I'll talk about that next week, but it's where you didn't want to go back. You wanted to give back. Is that a fair statement?
It is a fair statement. In fact, quite candidly, about mid-sentence, it's interesting to look back now, so many years later, but about mid-sentence, they selected in this particular prison of 500 men, five people to go out. Of course, we were, you know, chained and handcuffed and so forth. Not that any of us were going to do anything, but nonetheless, to go out and to speak to groups about the choices that we made and the consequences that followed. And I'll never forget, the first engagement was to a group of fifth graders.
Really?
And I could literally see when the three of us in that particular classroom were speaking that some of the kids, well, they didn't have to go to school that day in their minds, or at least it was a deviation, but you could tell in the eyes of some, they got it. And that was a defining moment for me. I knew that there had to be something positive to come from this experience. It wasn't just something that was mine alone, but something that could be potentially beneficial to others if I were willing to make a different set of choices. And that came down to me personally.
And so as you started to go through this process and you started to come into the gross realization you had this calling, if you will, is that were there just gratifying stages? Because I know over the years is that, you know, a lot of times we were thought we were fighting the man, the big man. And, you know, when we had what I used to call the evil empire, and, you know, I was on this show, just I was screaming. I was emotional, and I was, you know, just out of my body having these experiences and things about some of the things and the people that were sitting in front of me crying a lot, losing all their money. Is it, do you start to see that as you go through this process that you're making a difference, or you just think you're spinning your wheels?
No, actually, Vince, I really do. I believe that there is a difference that's being made. The interesting thing is it makes no difference whether it's an association, a corporation, a university, whomever. Every time that I have the opportunity to speak, to share the story, and to talk about how life will give you second chances if you make the right choices, there will always be people that will come up and share some of their very intimate and very personal stories of the prisons that they're in, not necessarily bar prisons, but right. the types of prisons that we find ourselves in by the choices that we make, and how inspirational it is to find that, yes, in fact, you can hit bottom and still become successful and survive if you refocus your efforts and your choices.
Right, and so there's reparations there, and there's different ideas. Is that, you know, one of the things I want to do is get you out here to speak one of these times in Dallas and in Houston, because I think it'd be very, very helpful in starting to understand some of the things that you and I probably today, you know, it doesn't pass the sniff test, and I think that's the first thing. You can get more people that you can educate, to include fifth graders. You know, I'm a big thing. I'm on a big campaign in junior finance here in the state of Texas to try and get financial education and literacy in schools, because I think that right. that's the basis. I mean, that you've got to, I don't care if it's a fifth grade or someplace else, is that I think those type of triggers need to be instilled as soon as possible in kids, because, you know, I think it will then hopefully, you know, start to proliferate in the fact that it will start to eliminate a lot of the things that we see today, because people a lot of times will make stupid decisions with their money. Yeah.
Well, people can make stupid, I hate to put it this way, people can make stupid decisions with their money, they can make stupid decisions with their life. Mm. And if we can help people connect the dots, that the choice that you make today has an impact tomorrow, and that there is some consequence. Now, consequence doesn't mean bad, it can be great, but there is a consequence based on the choices that we make. So when we begin to think, hey, you know what, I am actually empowered by my choices, maybe I'll start making a set of choices that are going to be financially rewarding and personally rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. You know, I can't agree with it more. Hey, Dan, do you have a question along these lines?
Well, I was just going to comment on how difficult it is, and I didn't want to interrupt you, Vince. After all, it's your show, and I'm just hanging out for the ride today, brother.
You and I both love Chuck. We're both fans.
Well, I agree, and Chuck, I have to tell you, you are due more credit than Vince or I could ever pass on, because we have a gentleman on our show every Friday, a guy named Michael Francese. He was the captain of the Colombo crime family. His dad was the underboss, and he comes on once a week, and he does what you do. He gets out and gives motivational talks, and he's out trying to say, here's what I did wrong, and here's what you need to do right. And I'm a good example of that. And the problem is, there are very few of you guys out there that took this as a moment in your life to create something really, really good long-term out of it. And I don't think anybody really realizes how difficult that proposition is. As much as you're underselling it right now, mm-hmm. Michael and I have become really good friends, and it is... you know, maybe the only thing tougher is having come out of a crime family, but it's a damn difficult proposition, and you're doing a lot of good for a lot of people.
Well, I appreciate the comments, but I'll also say to you that, you know, beyond the hope that I'm doing good for people is there, but the other side to that is to also help people understand that, you know, there are ways to avoid being scammed, and people have said to me before, well, you know, how do you know so much about it? Well, I was a scammer. You know, I created the fraud, so I know the things to look for and the things that people typically fall into. And if we can educate people, and you've got the financial show, so that's part of it right there, but educate people to know what to look for so that they can avoid it, so they don't end up being victims.
Right. Hey, Vince, let me tell you, I am a weird person. You talk about a person being struck by lightning five times in their life. Well, I am that weird person. I've had the fortune or the misfortune of being a witness for the U.S. attorney in three fraud cases up until now, and probably one or two more to go. And it's just been the luck of the draw that these people have been around me. I've seen their world, and I was fortunate to have an impact on maybe helping put these people in jail. So over the last, oh, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, I think I was adding it up, I think I've got almost 50 years The guys are serving almost 50 years because of some stuff I've done. And I don't know if it's God's will that he just made me say, you have to be around these people and you need to clean them up or not. But I have to tell you, it's rewarding to put people doing bad things away.
You know, and I agree with that. I agree. And I think back to Chuck's point is that making people aware and understanding because, you know, I think that I'm of average intelligence and I was around in the corporate environment. This was something I wanted to learn in the financial markets. I got ripped off by Smith Barney. I'm very, very open about that and, you know, how they churned my accounts. And it was just obvious what they did. And I named names and I've done that for years. And my thing was is that I wanted to go out and get educated to do this on my own, and then I went out and as far as these situations, I was gullible. I mean, I was the most gullible. Is that where Chuck was creating the fraud? I was sitting there in the chair going, "Wow, that is great!" And let me do it. And I spent a lot of money, and not to the tune of, you know, millions like some of these folks that I've met, but I hook, line, and sinker were following along with him, you know, and because I didn't know what I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know what the sniff test was. And that's why I'd like Chuck, if he could spend a few minutes with us and say, if this is the feeling that you're getting when you're listening to something like that, that's the red flag. Chuck, do you have a list of those?
Well, yeah, let's talk about that for just a second. I commonly refer to it as people falling into the pit. Mm-hmm. And it's not a hole, but it almost becomes one, or at least you certainly create that for yourself. But just about every case that you look at, what takes place? Three common elements. Number one, there is a promise. And more times than not, the person making the promise understands something about human psychology. People like to feel that they're special. No one wants to necessarily feel just normal. So the fraudster is going to make a promise. Let me give you a couple simple examples. I mean, it depends upon the economic circumstance, but one of the ones that I've been writing about. I promise that you're going to get a consistent 10% return. Now, I'm getting 12. The spread is 2. I'm making 2. Okay, now it starts the dots to connect. It seems plausible. But in 2008, going into 2009, even 2010, to tell somebody I'm going to guarantee you 10%, when in reality, that's not really something that you can do. That's impractical. It seems very special. That guarantee is the promise. Okay. And that happens. It's mind-boggling to me that people will consistently take the hook of the unrealistic promise based upon the fact that they're special, and they bite. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fish always seems to bite. The promise is supported by an illusion. More times than not, the illusion comes in a variety of ways. It may be the home the fraudster lives in. It may be the surroundings that they put themselves in so that they appear to have greater value than perhaps they realistically do. Or it may be, there was one, a fellow that I reported on, and he sent out statements. The statements were fraudulent, much like Bernie Madoff's, except in his case he wasn't quite so good. Because he called it, let's see, Fannie Mac and Freddie Mae.
Well, and Chili Mac.
You know, it's like, okay, dude, you messed up on that little statement there, brother. And, of course, one of the investors saw it, and that was literally the beginning point of the fraud becoming unraveled. But if I have the promise, I've got the illusion. The third component is most of the time it is based on trust. And I don't mean to be rude with this statement, but if I was a fraudster and I could somehow suck Vince in to investing, in my fraud, and Vince and I can develop enough trust, he and his trust will sell people that he trusts, and that will be the way I'm able to continue my fraud and let it expand.
Yeah. Sure.
So promise, illusion, and trust creates the pit for the person who's a victim.
And again, is that there's just so many examples of the different types of things that you start to see in these situations, and as you start to, you know, kind of put some meat on the bone to some of these, and you start to see how all of this kind of comes together, is that you've got something that you start to talk about, and you start to look at these different things. How does it kind of change, or is it always the same? Is it just the shtick is a little bit different, or something a little bit different in each? But all these components are there, and then once they're there, there's no getting around them. Yeah.
Well, typically, I found the primary components are there. If I'm the fraudster, if I'm the creator of the fraud, there's three components: need, opportunity, and rationalization. And if those three things come together for the fraudster, I'm apt to commit the fraud. It's the perfect storm for the creation of it. But the people who become victimized always fall prey to some promise supported by some illusion and based on trust. I mean, Bernie Madoff, there were many members of the Jewish community who complained that Bernie Madoff was targeting that particular community. And I sat back and I have to say, no, I don't think he was really targeting that community. That's where the trust was. Mm-hmm. So the fraudster isn't going to make it hard for himself or herself. They're going to do their fraud or perpetrate their fraud on the people who are most susceptible to bite.
And this is an interesting component, because I actually talked about it last week. About a week ago, we were asked to come out and speak at a church, a local church and stuff. And it was interesting is that affinity fraud was another situation that just this morning, as I heard about this Wichita, and it was actually in Wichita, Kansas, where this case was, that came to trial, and the guy had gotten through the church. You know, it was through the church where he was creating his own little following or fellowship that ultimately invested in his scam. And he's from Texas, too. He was out from Texas. I don't know exactly where. I'm going to read the story later. But I just heard about it this morning. And it was exactly, as you said, is that he created he found his group of people. They all started a following. They believed in him. And at the end of the day, he was an absolutely fabulous salesperson, and that's one of the things that they said as he actually testified, that you could tell he was definitely a marketer.
Well, you're going to go after the people that are the most vulnerable, and there's nothing more vulnerable than people in a religious setting, mm-hmm. People that have opened their hearts, that are ready to take a message. And I had a friend of mine call me last week and talk to me about of this guy that was offering gold, selling gold over the internet, and over the phone. And I said, just don't do it. I said, if you're buying gold, have them put it in your hand, and you put the money in their hand. He goes, well, no, it's okay. He's providing these services to churches. They said, he's doing what? Run as fast as you can from this guy.
One minute, Vince.
He's selling gold, and he's providing services to churches. The only thing left for him to do is to live in Boca Raton, and you've got the trifecta of all criminals. And it was pretty funny. About two or three days later, after a little research, it turned out, yep, this guy had two major frauds in his life, and it was just by the luck of God that those three instances smelled bad to us. But clearly you try to stop people from stepping into something that smells like that.
Yeah, so much. And Chuck, you probably see it day to day, huh?
Well, you certainly
Chuck, hold on one second. Yeah. Hold on. Hey, Chuck, can you hold on to that thought? We got a speed bump in the show here. We're gonna go take a break. We're gonna be right back. We're gonna get Ike to push a whole bunch of buttons, and we're gonna be back in less than 4 minutes here on the Mighty 1190 right after this.